Hello and welcome, everyone, to another episode of They Might Be Mariners, Lookout Landing's Prospects Miners focused podcast. I'm your host, John Troopin. I'm joined today by staff writer Joe Doyle. Joe.
Hello, hello.
And we're very excited to also have a guest today. We have Carlos Collazo of Baseball America. Carlos, how are you today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me, guys. Happy to be here.
Indeed. So, Carlos, obviously an expert on the draft, on minor league baseball, all sorts of things. And we're going to dig into a variety of sort of strange things going with the draft and how really out of whack and unprecedented a lot of the things. Joe, do you want to kick us off here?
Yeah, man, we're excited to have you, and we're excited to have you know, someone from Baseball America that, you know, spends 24/7 on the draft. And so, as a subject matter expert in the field, let's just kick things off with, what were your thoughts when you heard the draft was, you know, initially there were rumors that it was going to be canceled altogether, but when they settled on that 5-round, you know, possibly 10-round draft, you know, what were your impressions of that?
Yeah, when they announced they were having a draft in the first place, my first reaction was excitement. Obviously, like you mentioned, there were some rumors that the draft might not happen. Pretty quickly, we realized that seemed a little bit far-fetched. Most of the people that we talked to pretty regularly definitely anticipated a draft happening. Obviously, with the situation we're dealing with right now, you kind of have to go through all of your options. But first and foremost, I was just excited there was going to be a draft. Kind of after that, you start thinking through some of the ramifications of a shorter draft. Obviously, this is going to push out a lot of the high school players, a lot of the college juniors, maybe even some of the seniors, depending on what kind of situation they're at with their college, whether they'll get the financial support they need to kind of head back for another year. Yeah, but it's going to be a lot different. It's interesting to kind of think through a draft. I mean, we normally talk about a draft that's 40 rounds, obviously, and now we're going to look at something quite a bit different, whether that's 5 rounds, whether that's 10 rounds. I'm just excited to see how it plays out, but obviously bummed for the amateur players who are getting the short end of the stick in this one.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's been talked about quite a bit in our circles here at Lookout Landing. We, you know, we definitely have a special place for some of these guys that are selected in, you know, not only after the 5th round, but the 10th round. And, you know, there's a lot of success stories that come out of the 20th round and beyond. But there is seemingly a growing sentiment among the industry that maybe those rounds 25 through 40 are, I don't want to say totally futile, but they're kind of organization builders, if you will, and a lot of them don't have the scouting reports or you know, the track record to be maybe selected as potential big leaguers. So I know you've talked to some MLB scouts in the last couple of weeks that have kind of shared that similar sentiment to you. Where do you stand on it, and what kind of things have you heard about shortening the draft in general?
Yeah, I've talked to scouts who are both ways. I think it depends on who you're talking to. There are some area scouts who really value the back end, because that's where they can kind of get some of those guys they believe in. And obviously, there are always exceptions. There are always players who pop, who go in those later rounds. But mm-hmm. I think for me personally, when you just kind of look at the percentages and you look at where Major League Baseball is going with their minor league alignment, and the draft next year is going to be a minimum of 20 rounds, I have always kind of thought that 40 rounds is too long. You look at the number of players who are even signed in that range. Most teams don't sign all 40 rounds. I think 20 to 25 rounds is appropriate. And I think, especially when we're talking about realigning the minor leagues and getting rid of some of these lower level minor league teams, it just makes sense. Again, I think no matter what your cutoff is, there will always be some players who might have had a chance to make it if there were a few more rounds or a few more picks. But at some point, you have to draw the line. And I do think that the 25 rounds gives you enough of a pool to get the players that you want into professional baseball. And I do think that a lot of this realignment we're talking about at the minor league level is going to push some of those organization types out of baseball. And while that's disappointing for them, I think for minor league baseball as a whole and for prospects, playing against good competition, I think it has a chance to be a good thing. I know that's probably a minority opinion when you look at most people's thoughts on the minor league reconstruction, but depending on how it goes, I think it could make minor league baseball as a whole a better product.
Well, I think that's the conversation in and of itself, right? Is weighing the pros and cons of, you know, doing something like that, and while, you know, removing some of these teams from small markets and, you know, the culture that they've built in those towns, you do have to see both sides of the conversation to really get a full representation of what it would mean for baseball as a whole. So, John, where do you stand on minor league contraction? Where do you fall in this?
It's definitely something that is worrisome to me from a, like, baseball, capital B baseball perspective, because I think one of the, you know, exciting things just in a fan venue is you have these variety of quality and accessibility levels for the product. You know, you can go see reasonable quality baseball for a cheap cost if you're not living near, you know, an MLB town, and removing access to that, you know, throughout the, you know, the Mountain West sort of region, and a lot of other areas, you know, that sucks. I mean, it's a real, it would be really gutting, I think, for the game and for those communities. I do, at the same time, I think there is something to the developmental quality level, not necessarily that, like, oh, these facilities are so terrible now that we can't put people there, but, like, the idea that you could send players, you know, fewer steps along the way and have players all, you know, have a lot of guys in one area where you have consistent instruction, you can kind of consistently monitor them. I get the logic there. I just worry that, you know, removing affiliation is going to not necessarily be supplementable by, oh, you put in indie ball then. Like, that's a really hard model to sustain. Mm-hmm. And that's a bummer, even though I get the logic behind it.
Right. So let's shift a little bit towards this year's draft. It's going to be an interesting one. There's, you know, potentially going to be 5 rounds. It could go up maybe to 10. We'll see. There's a couple of things that I wanted to talk about specifically with how this shortened draft will affect a couple of teams. And the first one I wanted to talk about was the Houston Astros. And this is something you and I haven't had a great deal of opportunity to talk about with. But with a team that's already been sanctioned to lose their first 2 round picks, they've got a compensatory pick and rounds 3 through 5, potentially, to make their picks. About $2 million to spend over the course of 4 picks. Carlos, if you are someone in the Astros front office, that's obviously a huge handicap. But at the same time, if the draft is shortened, do you think that ends up helping the Astros a little bit in the fact that, well, now everyone's not going to get that many picks, so the chances of hitting on a player are worse for everyone? Or do you think it hurts them even more because their bonus pool is going to be so small that they're not going to be able to reach for, you know, a high-end high school talent type of thing when they eventually do hit the clock?
Yeah, I think you maybe could argue that it hurts everyone, but I do think that it disproportionately affects the Astros. I mean, if you're looking at a 5-round draft, they have 4 picks, I think, and then you've got, like you said, a little over $2 million in pool money. It just doesn't leave you a lot of options, and when you're missing out on the picks at the top of the draft, like, if it's shortened, those picks at the top of the draft are even more important, just because that's where the bulk of your value is probably going to come from. So when you don't have your first and your second round picks in a draft class that's very strong, one of the stronger draft classes we've had recently, oh, and you can't make it up by just drafting well at the back of the draft, because there is no back of the draft, at least in the traditional sense, I think that's really, it's just a bad spot in general. You're losing out on a great draft class in terms of talent, and then next year's class has a chance to be even better with all these kids who are getting pushed to the JUCO level or getting another year of eligibility. So I think it's a bad situation if you're the Astros. Obviously, you always want more picks, so I think it's pretty obvious to say it's not good for the Astros and for teams like the Yankees, mm-hmm. who just don't have a ton of picks. It's not great.
And then another scenario that I wanted to bring up, Carter Stewart, a couple of years ago, decided to not sign with, I think it was the Braves, when he was selected, like, 8th overall. And he decided to go overseas and play in Japan and, you know, make $6 million in the years that, or $8 million, something along those lines, in the years that he would have been controllable with the Braves organization. So my question is, with there only being five rounds, there's going to be guys that are left out. There's going to be, you know, junior draft eligible players, sophomore draft eligible players that could leave school and go play overseas right away. With bonus pools being smaller, with the draft being smaller, could you see an instance where a wave of these draft eligible players say, you know what, I'd rather, you know, go make a bunch of money overseas and then come back after I turn 25? Or, you know, is that going to become more of a reality?
Yeah, it could. I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you talk about MLB basically limiting where teams can spend and how much they can spend on amateur talent. Obviously, with everything that's going on in the economy, it makes sense that MLB teams don't want to spend on amateur talent, but at the same time, the draft in the international market is still the cheapest that you're ever going to get baseball talent. That's real value. Now, it'll be interesting to see what those other leagues, those foreign leagues, whether that's Japan, whether that's another foreign league, are they in a situation, because it is a global pandemic, are they in a situation where they also are spending less money? I think a lot of people are kind of just assuming that, oh, you can't get in the draft, we'll just go to another country and play. I don't know the financial situation of those leagues to say whether or not they're hurting as much as MLB clubs at least are perceived to be hurting. But I do think that Carter Stewart showed that there is a viable path if you don't think the draft is right for you. Obviously, Carter Stewart was, we thought, a top 10 talent in the 2018 class. The Braves didn't like what they saw on his medical. And then he gave it a whirl in the JUCO level, kind of saw where his stock was for the next year and just decided, hey, this is going to be a better route for me. I think depending on how badly players want to just enter pro ball, regardless, I think there is still an allure of being in an affiliated system. And I think there are obvious reasons for that. It wouldn't shock me, I guess, if there were a number of players who decided that the Carter Stewart route was one that they could benefit from.
Well, let's shift a little bit to this year's players, because I want to talk a little bit in terms of what's the situation here in Seattle. Seattle has a very interesting selection, being that they have the sixth pick in the draft, and a lot of chat, a lot of you know, forums and things like that, a lot of experts have said that kind of six is where the draft might start this year, because you've got a top five that a lot of people are assuming will go chalk in Spencer Torkelson, Asa Lacy, Emerson Hancock, Nick Gonzalez, and who's the last one of that group?
Austin Martin,
that's right. So Seattle's in an interesting spot at number six. I want to go over a couple of names that might work or might be of interest to Seattle at number six, and kind of get your feel for what the industry thinks of them and what you think of them. So I think the first place to start would be Reed Detmers out of Louisville. Big, big curveball. Doesn't have a ton of velocity. What do you think?
I think Reed is one of the more polished pitchers in this class. It's a very strong year for college pitching in general, and I think Reed entering the year, he was one of those guys who scouts looked at as maybe the best control and command of any of the pitchers in this class, and what he did in his abbreviated 2020 season kind of backed that up. He's a guy who, like you said, he doesn't have the biggest velocity, a fastball that kind of tops out at 93, 94 at this point, but he's got a huge hammer curveball that's an obviously plus pitch now, good changeup. He's tinkered with a slider a little bit, but the curveball is his better breaking ball. I think if you want a pick that's going to give you a lot of safety, Reed Detmers is probably your guy. His upside is maybe like a number three type arm if everything goes well. But I think I've talked to a number of different scouts who think he has kind of one of the higher baselines, one of the higher floors of this entire draft class. And there's a lot of value in that, obviously, when you're dealing with something as unknown as amateur talent.
Sure. With a pick as high as number six, though, and, you know, you've got a lot of other arms in the draft with, you know, high velocity gasoline in their arms. A name like Max Meyer comes up. So I think Max, most would probably agree, has a little bit higher ceiling than Detmers might, but there's some question marks there. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you're looking for the best pure stuff in the class, I mean, Max Meyer is one of the first guys that you would talk about. I think Garrett Crochet is another guy, left-hander at Tennessee, but Max is a guy who has maybe the best amateur slider scouts have seen in recent years. I think there are a couple guys who you might bring up and say, oh, this one is comparable, but we've had multiple scouts who said his slider is the best amateur slider they've ever scouted. You pair that with fastball velocity into the upper 90s, and while it was only a few starts this season, he showed he could hold that velocity throughout his outings and across all four of those starts. So I think he answers some questions about the starter reliever concerns you might have with him just because of his size and the relative lack of track record. He's got some starts under his belt at Minnesota. But you look at a guy who's throwing that hard and is just 6 foot like he's listed at, there are some concerns there. How's he going to hold up in terms of durability, in terms of the stuff in a professional starting role? But he does it with without too much effort. He's extremely athletic on the mound, and he's a pretty good strike thrower as well. So I think you have a lot of check marks that you can go through with Max Meyer. And like you said, he does have pretty significant upside. I mean, two easy plus-plus pitches and a solid changeup as well when he gets to start using that more consistently.
Okay, so a third name that I want to bring up is a little bit of a favorite amongst the community out here as who they'd like to see selected number six, and that's because of the hype train and the comparisons that are being thrown around with Florida outfielder Zach Veen, prepster. What are your thoughts on Veen, and do you think the hype of Veen and some of the comparisons that he's drawn actually match the package?
Yeah, I love Zach Veen. I think he's got one of the prettiest swings I've ever seen. I mean, it's a very smooth, loose, handsy. He's got an excellent frame. He's like 6'4", 6'5", 200 pounds. He added a ton of muscle over the offseason. I mean, his swing is just geared for power. On top of that, he's got exceptional plate discipline. I would say he's probably one of the better guys that I've seen in the last 3 or 4 years in terms of just approach at the plate. So those are a lot of things to like right off the bat. I do think there are some swing and miss concerns. I've seen him whiff a little bit more than you probably would want to see. But I do think that he has just mechanically, his eye, his physicality, his raw power now, I think he has tremendous upside. I mean, at this point, he's the top high school player on our board. Him and Austin Hendrick are kind of neck and neck, and they share some similarities. But I think just when you look at... When you want to dream on a guy, I think Zach Veen is a very easy player to dream on. And it doesn't surprise me at all that so many people kind of paying attention to the draft have really latched onto him as a guy to like. It's obviously tough to compare him to like a Christian Yelich or a Cody Bellinger, considering what those guys have done. I think mechanically it's easy to make those comps. As far as like how that tool set will play out in 3 or 4 or 4 or 5 years when he's potentially making his way to the major leagues, could be a little bit different from those guys. But, I mean, again, he's very easy to dream on. He's one of my favorite bats in the class, personally.
Just as a quick segue on the whole comp subject, where do you fall? I know you put out a little poll on Twitter the other day. Where do you fall on comps? Are they constructive? Are they destructive? What do you think?
Yeah, I thought it was a fascinating conversation just because as we were kind of writing these reports, we see a lot of comps that scouts put on players, and I personally don't like to throw comps on players. I think it just depends. Like if you're a scout or an evaluator or even a fan who's been watching the game at kind of an in-depth level for a long time, your kind of personal catalog of players is pretty vast, and it'll be a little bit easier to throw those comps. But I just feel like me personally, I haven't seen a lot of these guys. Like if you compare Christian Yelich, like I didn't see Christian Yelich when he was in high school when he was an amateur player. So it's very tough for me to throw comps on these guys, not knowing kind of where they came from all the time. So I think if you have put the work into making the comp, they can be useful. At the same time, every player is different. They all do it differently. They all have different mentalities. So I think it can be a bit disingenuous both sides to throw a comp on a player. So I think it gets dicey. I also think people don't know that you can compare swings. You can compare bodies. You can compare mentalities. So a comp can be all sorts of different things depending on what you're actually going for. So I just think knowing what you're comparing, knowing who's comparing what player and what they're kind of trying to say in that comp, all that matters. In general, I think it's just safer to steer clear of them. But I do understand how they can be fun, and obviously they can kind of give you a quick idea of what a player is like if you're more casually into it or you just aren't super into like all the in-depth stuff and the scouting reports that we can provide.
Sure. Yeah, and I mean, I think the Yelich comp is it's an easy comp to make with Zach Veen today because the leverage that he gets on the swing, he looks like Yelich now, but a lot of people don't realize that Christian Yelich, when he was drafted, was, you know, half the size that Zach Veen is today. And he had a flat swing. I mean, he wasn't a home run hitter. So, yeah, everyone ages and, you know, progresses differently. So, John, do you have a thought on just comps in general?
Yeah, I think Carlos summed it up really nicely. I find it very valuable to have sort of a well-constructed comp because it is a way of sort of translating, I think, something that people have put a lot of time and a lot of sort of study on into something that might be a little bit more universally tangible. But the danger there is, you know, like Carlos said, you know, you might make a comparison based on a variety of factors or only even a narrow fact, you know, sort of set of factors. And if people take that and say, you know, oh, okay, well, that means that this is exactly what they're going to be. You know, it's like the, you know, a scientific study being done and then versus what the headline of an article about that scientific study ends up being. You know, it's that kind of thing where you have to be very careful.
That's a great analogy. I like that.
Yeah. Well, I've only got a few more questions for you here. You recently put out a question, or I should say a podcast. If you haven't checked out Baseball America's website, or you haven't subscribed, they're putting out the best content right now for minor league ball and the MLB draft. And with there not being tangible, actual baseball on diamonds right now, it's a great place to go get, you know, your fix, if you will. Mm-hmm. But Carlos, you put out an interesting podcast this week talking about some of the players that are hurt most by a shortened draft and just a shortened a work stoppage in general. And a couple of those are two names that have been attached to Seattle in the past. And one I really want to focus on, and that's Mick Abel. He's a Pacific Northwest kid, big fastball, 6'5", but he did struggle last summer. Talk to us a little bit about Mick, and do you think he's just kind of missed his opportunity to get up to that number six spot with Seattle because of what's going on?
Yeah, I think struggle might be a little bit strong. I think last summer maybe he was more inconsistent in terms of stuff. He did struggle at certain events. So just like when you're talking about what specific events he might have struggled. But overall, I think he had a fine summer. But he does have some of the best upside in the class. I think right now we have him as the number two high school prospect, and we have him right outside of that top 10 range. So just considering kind of the strength of the college guys at the top, those kind of elite players that are in the top 10 right now, I would think just based on the kind of risk associated with high school right-handers specifically and the 2020 draft cycle, how it's kind of all unfolded. I mean, Mick Abel didn't get to throw for his high school team a single time this spring. Scouts might have seen a bullpen or two. So to make that guy your number six pick in the draft, I think brings a ton of risk, even more so than it typically would. And Mick is a guy who, like you said, he's a 6'5". I think we have him listed at 180. There's a good chance he is significantly heavier than that after putting on some good weight over the offseason. He's a guy who could have changed dramatically over the offseason. The scouts just don't know kind of what he is right now. So it's a lot of risk that you're putting. And I think kind of where he was at coming into this year, and the players ahead of him, I would imagine six would be a stretch. At the same time, if you're talking about a team who really liked him, saw him well over the summer, and gets good information whenever teams are allowed to gather new video. I know some of the scouting regulations were lifted a little bit, but I just think in general that's a pretty big risk for six when you have some more serious, or not serious, some more maybe safe picks who have just as much talent as Mick Abel ahead of him.
Sure. And then the other one was Garrett Crochet out of Tennessee. A lot of people prior to the season starting had him possibly being an option for Seattle at number six. I know he had some arm troubles early in the year and he was only able to get in maybe one start. But do you think he's still floating in that 6 to 8 range, or where does he fall?
It wouldn't surprise me. It would surprise me less if Crochet jumped up into that range than Abel, just because you're looking at a guy who at least has some college track record. Teams would have liked to get more starting track record this year. The arm was a concern, but he did show the same impressive stuff in a brief three-inning debut before the season got shut down. But you're talking about a guy that has one of the better fastballs in the entire class from the left side. Good big frame, an easy plus slider when it's on. So I think that would make a little bit more sense. And he is a guy who definitely had a chance to jump into that top 10 range with a strong spring. Without having that, it's a bit more of an unknown now. But again, I talked about this when we talked about Max Meyer. I think he's a guy who potentially has some of the biggest pure upside in the class outside of like the top three or four guys.
Sure. Okay, well, Carlos, I'm going to put you on the clock here with the last two questions. We spoke a little earlier about Seattle being one of the more interesting picks in the draft at number six, with the top five possibly going as chalk. Let's put the Mariners on the clock right now with the sixth overall pick in the draft. We've talked about some different names. If you're Jerry DePoto, who's the name you're calling if the draft is today?
Ooh, this is a good one. Okay, so if it's me, I'm just going to assume the top five guys are off the board that we've already mentioned. So that would leave me personally deciding between Garrett Mitchell, UCLA outfielder, I think maybe the toolsiest college player in the class, Reed Detmers, and probably Zach Veen, who we talked about. I think those are the three guys that I would be interested in. And I think at that point, I'd probably go with Garrett Mitchell. We haven't talked about him a ton, but I think he just has a lot of safety with his supplemental tools and just tremendous upside if he actually does figure out how to hit for power. He's got plus-plus raw power in the tank. He's an 80-grade runner, projected to be a plus or plus-plus defender in center field. Elite bat-to-ball skills. He doesn't have the best track record of hitting. He's been a tinkerer like his entire baseball career, going back to his high school days. He never really hit for any kind of power as a high schooler and really hasn't done it a ton in college. So I think if you're a team that has good player development, you can kind of figure out how to leverage his swing a little bit and harness that natural bat-to-ball ability. I just love his upside. I mean, that kind of impact ability as a runner, as a power hitter, potentially as a center fielder, I think that combination of everything is just too much for me to pass up personally. He's a bit more polarizing than some of the players we've talked about, but I'm buying in.
All right, well, the Mariners do have the picks. They do have the bonus pool to spend, so certainly not out of the question. Carlos, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. You've been an excellent guest, and stay in touch here in the next couple of months. We're loving the work that you're doing over there at BA. Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, John, Carlos was obviously an excellent addition to the show. Gave some really interesting names and interesting insight. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you could take away from his information and his opinions?
Certainly. I think the Garrett Mitchell sort of possibility there, because it was a really interesting one, and it's one that you and I talked about, and I think perhaps you and Carlos, and I know you've talked with folks about it as well. You actually changed my mind a little, or changed my perspective at least a little bit on Mitchell, because he's been someone who, you know, I don't love his swing. I think it looks a little herky-jerky and uncomfortable at the plate. He is incredible. You know, he's got the strength, he's got the speed, and he's been, you know, a strong hitter, but obviously the home run numbers haven't quite been there in college. And it's very much, I think, it's difficult for me to not look at what the Mariners have as an opportunity right now, picking high in the draft this year, probably picking high in the draft next year, depending on how that works out.
That'll be interesting to follow.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a whole nother animal. But
with 16 losses, the Mariners.
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and think like the Mariners have not really had an opportunity to go for the high level, like sky high ceiling kind of talent like Zach Veen. you know, in a while, because they've been picking sort of the middle of the draft. You know, obviously Kyle Lewis, they got in the teens of the draft, but even that was, you know, 11th overall, if I'm not mistaken. But you sort of put the point that, like, Evan White was a guy kind of like Garrett Mitchell in the sense of, like, everyone could see the athleticism was there. You know, all those supplemental tools, like Carlos said, are going to be enough to carry him, you know, defensively, carry him, you know, to be a good base runner. So if he is, in fact, able to harness the power and the, you know, exit velo into a more efficient swing, suddenly you have, you know, you have a full package there. And you're looking at someone who's very exciting as a prospect. So I think that's, you know, there are a lot of really promising possibilities for the Seattle there. And I am encouraged, by the way that the draft sort of, lines up with what Seattle needs in a way last year's draft arguably didn't. You know, obviously Seattle went very heavy on pitching last year, which was not reputationally what that draft was going to be particularly strong on. I think they got some good guys out of it, but that was, you know, it remains to be seen. And this year, I think if they're able to, in fact, get 5 rounds, hopefully 10 rounds out of it, you know, they could really stock their system pretty nicely.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, when the draft is this deep and this talented, if you're Jerry DePoto, you have to take the best player on the board. And as much as I love Reed Detmer's curveball, I mean, you could, it sounds like a lot of fun to watch that curveball in person for 6 years. I mean, that sounds like a lot of fun. But at the same time, like Carlos said, if he is a mid-rotation ceiling, but also, from the sounds of it, a mid-rotation floor. You know, you've got a number three.
Right. As much as a pitcher can be.
Yeah, right. It's really hard when the draft is this deep and this talented to not take the biggest ceiling.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, the last time Seattle, I think, you know, again, Lewis was like, oh my God, Kyle Lewis fell to them. Mm-hmm. Of course you take Kyle Lewis. But, like, you know, they didn't have a first-round pick the year before that. 2014, the last time they picked in the top 10, they took a high school outfielder who had probably the best offensive ceiling by many scouts in the draft in Alex Jackson, and it didn't work out, but that doesn't mean that type of pick is bad. You know, that there, you know, it made sense to go for this incredibly talented offensive player who was maybe a catcher. At the very least, you could put him in the outfield and had the, you know, had reasonable athleticism, had a really strong arm. So, you know, it's still, I think, a sound strategy to go for that sort of high upside play that the Mariners really haven't gone for in the last several years.
Yeah. I mean, listen, Alex Jackson didn't work out, but if you go back, I'm just going to go back 5 years because that's how long it should take a high school player to work his way up the ranks. If you go and you look at the highest outfielder taken from the high school ranks.
Oh, this is a very fun thing to do. It's just going back for a ways, yeah.
It is, yeah. So Alex Jackson, unfortunately, was 2014, 2015. Mm-hmm. You got Kyle Schwarber. I mean, that's a resounding success. Mm-hmm. You go back to 2013, you've got Clint Frazier, who, while he hasn't panned out yet, he has shown he's just blocked is one way to say it. I mean, he's got the tools, he just needs an opportunity. Mm-hmm. The year before that, the highest prep outfielder is Byron Buxton. The year before that, not as good. You got Bubba Starling, but he finally made his introduction last year. And then, let's see, we'll go one more. The year before that, you got Delino DeShields Jr. So, you know, they've all made their big league debuts. They haven't been the stars that some were, you know, tabbing them to be. But at the same time, in my opinion, Zach Veen is in that stratosphere of Byron Buxton when he was taken in terms of talent. I remember when Clint Frazier and Austin Meadows were taken, they were both considered pretty safe bets to be big, you know, big time players, and they've both turned into that. So I think that's what Zach Veen could be. I think he could be an impact bat. Just to play devil's advocate, just because I have talked to scouts about this draft and what they're seeing, Garrett Mitchell is maybe the most split player that I've talked to people about. So I think I've talked to three or four people, and there are some that believe he's going to be a superstar and he's going to tap into 25 home run power. And then there are others, and the exact quote is that I got is, you just don't draft Adam Engel with the sixth pick in the draft.
Yeah,
which was startling to me because you definitely don't. So yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting. Seattle's in a tough spot because you really touch every different angle of the way you can approach a draft with this sixth pick.
Yeah. I think so. Even to sort of cheat one year further forward, I think that the number five overall pick in 2015 was, you know, another high school outfielder that I think, you know, in that comp talk, which I think is a very interesting one of, like, you know, we usually do comps to big leaguers, right? We do comps to people that are recognizable, that but that's not what guys look like when they're going to be drafted. Like, you get stronger, you get bigger, you get, you know, more refined. You learn a lot as you go. You know, like you know, Christian Yelich is not remotely close to the same player. So
no.
But I do think they're, you know, if you watch like Kyle Tucker video, you know, I think that's you know, Kyle Tucker, who still is kind of skinny as a rail, still has that kind of hilarious
Ted Williams thing. Baby.
Exactly.
Teddy ball game.
You know, I mean, that's, you know, obviously Tucker's had sort of up and down performance in the bigs, but he's kind of been blocked, like, you know, not as badly as Frazier, but he's not gotten a full take and go.
But he's been, I mean, you can go back 10, 15, 20 years. He's had maybe the most prodigious minor league career of a minor league outfielder that I can remember.
Yeah, it's like him and George Springer, and hey, both, you know, kind of the same.
Like, like hitting 340 everywhere at every level, 35 home runs everywhere, every year, every level, 30 stolen bases every year, every level. It's like you watch Jared Kelnick, and Jared Kelnick's like, you know, 290, 20 home runs, 21 stolen bases. Add 10 to every field.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's Kyle Tucker. So,
yeah,
he's a special talent. And that's the type of frame that you're acquiring if you go with Zach Veen. So, it'll be awfully interesting. Another thing that I wanted to talk a little bit about was, you know, Carlos, he talked a bit about, where is it? Max Meyer. Let's say Seattle doesn't go the Zach Veen route or the Garrett Mitchell route. They go pitcher, and you draft a guy that's got a little bit of he's got a little bit of durability concerns because he's 6 feet tall, he's 180 pounds, but he throws the ball 100 miles an hour, and he's got, you know, an insane slider. Are you comfortable going after a player like that this early in the draft with the ceiling that he's got? I mean, those type of arms don't last in general.
I mean, I honestly, I am. Like, the skill set that the Mariners have shown they've been able to develop is guys who, you know, many of the successes they've had are somewhat undersized guys who are willing to adjust and maximize, you know, the skills they have. That's been a lot of guys who have fringy stuff, you know, your LJ Newsoms, Darren McCackens, you know, Devin Sweets and Sam Delaplanes. Like, it, you know, it's guys who are making themselves into something where they could have previously been nothing. So I think if they're able to have that success and showcase, you know, point to high profile guys and say, look, we know what we're doing. Look at these guys we've shown. what they can do, hopefully, once they have guys who are already something, you know, and sort of transform that forward is, I think, is very exciting. And I think makes me less worried about size necessarily. And, you know, Seattle, I wouldn't say Seattle is necessarily particularly good at avoiding injuries. I think that's kind of a, you know, there, you can do some things well, but honestly, a lot of that is good fortune. But certainly they have shown no aversion to getting smaller guys thus far. You know, Justice Sheffield, Marco Gonzalez, like, these are not tall, you know, these are not picturesque starting pitchers necessarily. And they're still, you know, being quite successful with players like that. So Meyer, who has an absolutely, like, just gorgeous couple of pitches in the fastball and the slider. I mean, that is already exciting enough. So if they can find a way, like they have with you know, guys like Kirby and Logan Gilbert, who are obviously huge, to say, okay, we're going to have you take, you know, 5-10% off, and we're going to have you repeat your motion, you know, a little bit, you know, a little bit more consistently, and you're going to be, you know, 95-96 and still have that, you know, slide. I mean, that is that's really encouraging, and the type of thing that I would feel comfortable with this player development group working with.
Yeah, I mean, there's a track record for guys that are this size and they're this athletic. You know, I'm not drawing any comparisons, but you know, there's guys like Marcus Stroman that are 5'8" and they came up throwing gas. Tim Lincecum from UW, I mean, he was, I don't even think he was 6 feet, and I definitely know he wasn't 185, maybe getting out of the shower. He was throwing, you know, 98. And then the Royals late starting pitcher,
Yordano Ventura.
Yeah, I was going to say Yordan Alvarez. That's not right. Ventura.
Yeah,
I mean, so there's a track record of this sort of player working, especially if they're athletic, and Meyer is an athletic guy that gets down playing really, really well. He's got good mechanics. Like Carlos said, it's free and easy.
It's actually just like, if you want to watch, like, hey, this is what you kind of want to emulate as a pitcher, like, you just watch like some Max Meyer video. Like, he gets down the hill really nicely. Like, the weight transfer is spectacular, and like he's coming just with nice, just a nice easy release like every time. I mean, you know, you never know with pitchers. Like, tin stop is a thing for a reason. But I would not be scared off of him. Especially if the Mariners, you know, have the chance to sort of get some degree of medical information on him and think, okay, there's no baseline risk here, you know, more than any other pitcher, then yeah, I think he's very worth a look there.
So, having talked it out a little bit, you got Meyer, you got Veen, you got Detmers, you got Mitchell. I'll tell you what, it's not a bad position to be in, because Seattle could walk away with any one of those four players and feel pretty darn good. But is there a guy there that sticks out for you? I know Carlos had Garrett Mitchell.
Yeah. I think you've encapsulated it more or less perfectly. Like, it would be difficult for me to be supremely disappointed in any of the guys that I think are being bandied about there. Mitchell, obviously, I haven't seen it quite from him, the play, but I think the reason he is there is because he's shown some good things. He's shown, you know, plenty of good things, and you know there's more in there. If he's, you know, coached properly, and if he, you know, continues to grow. I will say I couldn't pass up on Zach Veen there. It is difficult to, I think that the Mariners are not like a, you know, they're not the Marlins. They're not the Rays. Like, they're not a team where it's like, okay, we have to line up all our ARB and pre-ARB guys and hope that they go, you know, hope that everything goes right before, and that they become stars before they, you know, before they leave in free agency. Like, the Mariners have plenty of money, and they're not like, you don't, they're not completely unappealing to free agents.
Well, and I think that's another thing that needs to be pointed out about this draft, that it's five rounds, and a lot of teams do not have the luxury of having seven picks.
Mm-hmm.
The Mariners have
right.
money, and if mm-hmm. they if they go with Veen in the first round,
mm-hmm.
and they've got to pay him, mm-hmm. then great. But yeah. if they don't go with Veen in the first round, and they go with a college player that signs mm-hmm. four slot,
mm-hmm.
they're going to be in a very unique position at 43
right.
to select a player that, I mean, wholeheartedly, half of the league will not have access to the types of players. They just yeah. won't be able to sign.
Yeah.
The types of players that Seattle might be able to sign at 43. So
yeah.
I don't know how far you've dug down on, you know, this draft class, or if you have any opinions on the matter. But is there a name that sticks out for you at 43, or maybe a philosophy that you'd like to see the team follow in the second pick?
They've sort of been going with you know, kind of a policy of, well, not a policy, but they've definitely been going, I think, with like a straight, sort of a straighter. Straighter laced, surefire signability kind of pick, you know, even if it is obviously someone who is a first round talent, like, you know, Gilbert was a first round talent, you know, Kirby, Evan White, like these are first round talents, but like then going with sort of a more upsidey play in the second round, or at least a more intriguing play. I would love to see them go for a catcher in the top couple picks there. I think that there's not a ton of catching depth in the system right now, and it's hard to, you know, obviously you kind of just go for, you know, the best player on your board at that point, but there's I am wary of the fact that it's Cal Raleigh and or Cal Raleigh, sorry, I've done it again. Cal Raleigh, and you know, a lot of question marks beyond that in Seattle's catching depth. You know, there's some interesting guys with tools, but I would like to see, you know, someone who I think has a good shot at making. I think this would be a good time to flip that script, I suppose, where you can go for that high upside guy. If they go Veen, like, then you go for, you know, a more consistent, like, okay, this is someone who we think has the defensive skill set, maybe the bat to make the bigs, and that you know, that I think would be very valuable for this system.
I think with a college class as deep as this one, as far as arms go, if they do go Veen in the first round, I would be surprised if they didn't go with a college arm mm-hmm. in the at 43. And just because, you know, you have a chance to land a high floor arm. There's a lot. There's, I mean, Bryce mm-hmm. Jarvis out of Duke would be an excellent option. Slade mm-hmm. Ciccone out of Miami would be a great option. You know, Cade Cavalli out of Oklahoma. There mm-hmm. are a ton of names that'll be possibly available in that range that I think Seattle would go for. But yeah, I like the prep catcher route. I think Kevin Parada that Carlos was talking about,
mm-hmm.
he would be an excellent addition to the organization. He's probably going to move pretty fast because of his bat. I know in having previous conversations that he's going to be expensive. Mm-hmm. He's going to cost first round money to get him mm-hmm. out of Georgia Tech. But that's the sort of thing that you do in this draft. If you've got the money and you're one of the few teams that has the money to land someone like Kevin Parada mm-hmm. or a Tyler Soderstrom and another bat-first prep catcher, you have to do it because this is your opportunity to do it.
Yeah.
Just a couple other names I want to hit on just because there are a couple of names that I'd like to see the team go after.
Mm-hmm.
I think Nick Lofton, the shortstop out of Baylor, would be a really nice addition. He's an average to an above average defensive shortstop that's always hit well, but he's never really tapped into the power. He dropped his hands this year out of nowhere. Nobody knew it was coming.
Mm-hmm.
A lot like what Evan White did. And he hit a ball at Minute Maid Park so far over the train tracks that in a game that it caught people's attention. It was the exit velo was like 112. I mean, it was I know it's a metal bat, but that's out of this world power. And I think he went on to hit. I could be totally wrong on this, but I think he went and hit like 8 home runs this year in the short sample size. So he's gone way up for me. And then Kevin Sabato would be a great one. Maybe Gage Workman, the third baseman shortstop out of Arizona State, would be another good one. So, it should be a fun draft. I think the fact that it's only 5 rounds might make it a little bit more appealing, like watchable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be shorter.
Yeah.
You don't have to dedicate Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday to it. I'm sure it's going to be done in, you know, if not one day, just, you know,
you
a
have
little
to
bit
imagine
over that.
It's one day. Yeah. I think,
yeah,
I think
it's going to go quick. Yeah. So, well, hey, man, I don't have too much to add. This has been another fun podcast. Really enjoying They Might Be Mariners. And, do you have anything to add?
No, I think it's a very weird time to try and do all of this, you know, obviously, because, you know, talking about the future of baseball when the present of baseball is so in flux. But hopefully you guys are enjoying it listening. Certainly it helps us sort of stay sharp and keep our minds in the game. We're gonna try and talk to some more sort of prospect and draft experts in the coming weeks here, which I think you guys are gonna enjoy. So thank you Joe for taking the lead on this and bringing Carlos on here.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Looking forward to doing a couple more of these here over the next few weeks and continuing to keep baseball alive.
Exactly. Yeah. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy.